Chapter 11. An Oath. You asked to be wakened before the sun, Mother. Egwene's eyes popped open. She had set herself a time to wake only moments from now, and despite herself she started back against her pillow from the face above her. Stern through a sheen of perspiration, it was not a pleasant sight first thing in the morning. Mary's manner was perfectly respectful, but a pinched nose, a permanently downturned mouth, and dark eyes sharp with censure said she had never seen anyone half as good as they should be or pretended to be, and her flat tone turned every meaning head to heels. "I hope you slept well, Mother," she said, while her expression managed a fair accusation of sloth. Her black hair, in tight coils over her ears, seemed to pull her face painfully. The unrelieved, drab, dark gray she always wore, however it made her sweat, only added to the gloom. It was a pity she had not managed a little real rest. Yawning, Egwene rose from her narrow cot and scrubbed her teeth with salt, washed her face and hands, while Mary laid out her clothes for the day, donned stockings and a clean shift, then suffered herself to be dressed. Suffered was the word. "I fear some of these knots will pull, Mother," the cheerless woman murmured, drawing the brush through Egwene's hair, and Egwene very nearly told her she had not deliberately tangled it in her sleep. "I understand we will rest here today, Mother." Bone idleness seethed Mary's reflection in the stand mirror. "This shade of blue will set off your colouring nicely, Mother," Mary said as she did up Egwene's buttons, her face an accusation of vanity. Filled with relief that she would have Chesa tonight, Egwene donned the stole and fled almost before the woman finished. Not even a rim of the sun showed above the hills to the east, the land humped up all around in long ridges and irregular mounds, sometimes hundreds of feet high, that often looked as though monstrous fingers had squeezed them. Shadows like twilight bathed the camp lying in one of the broad valleys between, but it was well awake in the heat that never really lifted. Smells of breakfast cooking filled the air, and people bustled about, though there was none of the rush that would have meant a day's marching ahead. White-clad novices darted about at a near run. A wise novice always carried out her chores as quickly as she could. Warders never seemed hurried, of course, but even servants carrying the morning meal to Aes Sedai appeared to stroll this morning. Well, almost, in comparison to the novices. The whole camp was taking advantage of the halt. A clatter and curses as a jack-lever slipped announced wagon wrights making repairs, and a distant tapping of hammers told of farriers reshoeing horses. A dozen candle-makers had their moulds lined up already, and the kettles heating to melt the carefully hoarded drippings and tag-ends of every candle that had been burned. More big black kettles stood on fires to boil water for baths and laundry, and men and women were heaping clothes up nearby. Egwene gave little notice to any of the activity. The thing of it was, she was certain Mary did not do it a purpose. She could not help her face. Even so, she was as bad as it would be to have Romanda for a maid. The thought made her laugh out loud. Romanda, as lady's maid, would have her mistress towing the line in no time. No doubt as to who would run and fetch in that pair. A grey-haired cook paused in raking coals from atop an iron oven to give her a grin of shared amusement, for a moment anyway. Then he realized he was grinning at the Ammerlin seat, not just some young woman walking by, and the grin melted crookedly as he jerked a bow before bending back to his work. If she sent Mary off, Romanda would only find a new spy, and Mary would again be starving her way from village to village. Adjusting her dress, she really had gone before the woman was quite finished. Egwene's fingers found a small linen bag, the strings tucked behind her belt. She did not have to lift it all the way to her nose to smell rose petals and a blend of herbs with a cool scent. It made her sigh. A face like a headsman's, spying for Romanda without any doubt, and trying to perform her duties as well as she could. Why were these things never easy? Approaching the tent she used as a study—many called it the Ammerlin's study, as if it were rooms in the tower—a solemn satisfaction replaced worry over Mary. Whenever they halted for a day, Shiriam would be there before her with fat sheaves of petitions. a laundress imploring clemency on a charge of theft when she'd been caught with the jewelry sewn into her dress, or a blacksmith begging a testimonial for his work, which he could not use unless he intended to leave, and likely not then. A harness maker asking the Ammerlin's prayers for her to give birth to a daughter. One of Lord Bryn's soldiers requesting the Ammerlin's personal blessing to his wedding a seamstress. There was always a slew from older novices, appealing visits to Tiana and even extra chores. Anyone had the right to petition the Ammerlin, but those in service to the tower seldom did, and never novices. Egwene suspected that Shiriam worked to dig up petitioners, something to butter the cat's paws, to keep her out of Shiriam's hair while the keeper took care of what she considered important. This morning Egwene thought she might make Shiriam eat those petitions for her breakfast. When she entered the tent, though, Shiriam was not there, which perhaps should not have been a surprise given the night before. The tent was not empty, however. "The light illumine you this morning, mother," Theodrin said, making a deep curtsy that set the brown fringe of her shawl swaying. She had all the fabled Domani grace, though her high-necked dress was really quite modest. Domani women were not known for modesty. "We did as you commanded, but no one saw anybody near Marigan's tent last night." "Some of the men remembered seeing Halima," Faolaine added sourly, with a much briefer bend of her knees. But aside from that, they hardly recalled whether they went to sleep. Many women disapproved of Delana's secretary, but it was her next remark that made Faolaine's round face darker than usual. "We met Tiana while we were roaming about. She told us to go to bed and be quick about it." Unconsciously, she stroked the blue fringe on her shawl. New Aes Sedai almost always wore their shawls more often than they needed to, so Swan said. Giving them a smile she hoped was welcoming, Egwene took her place behind the small table. Carefully. The chair tilted for a moment anyway, until she reached down and pulled the leg straight. An edge of folded parchment peeked out from beneath the stone inkwell. Her hands twitched toward it, but she made them be still. Too many sisters saw little need for courtesy. She would not be one of those. Besides, these two had a claim on her. "I am sorry for your difficulties, daughters." Made Aes Sedai by her decree on being raised Ammerlin, they faced the same predicament as she, but lacking the added shield of the Ammerlin's stole, small shield that had proved. Most sisters behaved as though they were still only accepted. What went on inside the Ajahs was seldom known outside, but it was rumored that they truly had had to beg admittance, and that guardians had been named to oversee their behavior. No one had ever heard the like, but everyone took it for fact. She had done them no favor. Another thing that had been necessary, though. "I will speak to Tiana. It might do some good. For a day. Or an hour." "Thank you, mother," Theodrin said. "But there is no need to bother yourself." Still, she also touched her shawl, hands lingering. "Tiana wanted to know why we were up so late," she added after a moment. "But we didn't tell her." "There was no need for secrecy, daughter." A pity they had not found a witness, though. Mogedion's rescuer would remain a shadow half-glimpsed, always the most frightening sort. She glanced at the tiny corner of parchment, itching to read it. Maybe Swan had discovered something. "Thank you both." Theodrin recognized a dismissal and made her manners to go, but stopped when Faolaine remained where she was. "I wish I had held the oath rod already," Faolaine told Egwene in tones of frustration, "so you could know what I say is true." "This isn't the time to bother the Ammerlin," Theodrin began, then folded her hands and turned her attention to Egwene. Patience blended with something else on her face. Clearly the stronger of the two in the power, she always took the lead, yet this time she was prepared to step back. In aid of what, Egwene wondered. "It isn't the oath rod that makes a woman Aes Sedai, daughter, whatever some believed. Speak the truth to me and I will believe it." "I don't like you." Faolaine's mop of dark curls swayed as she shook her head for emphasis. "You must know that. You probably think I was mean when you were a novice, when you came back to the White Tower after running away. But I still believe you didn't get half the punishment you should have. Maybe my admitting it will help you know I speak the truth. It isn't as though we have no choice even now. Romanda offered to take us under her protection, and so did Lelaine. They said they'd see we were tested and raised properly as soon as we returned to the tower. Her face grew angrier, and Theodrin rolled her eyes and broke in. Mother, what Faerlane is fumbling all around without getting to the point is that we didn't attach ourselves to you because we had no choice, and we didn't do it in gratitude for the shawl. She pursed her lips, as if thinking that raising them Aes Sedai in the manner Egwene had was not really a gift to inspire much gratitude. Then why? Egwene asked, leaning back. The chair shifted, but held. Faerlane jumped in before Theodrin could more than open her mouth. Because you are the Ammerlin Seat, she still sounded angry. We can see what happens. Some of the sisters think you're Shiriam's puppet, but most believe Romanda or Lelaine tells you where and when to step. It is not right. Her face was twisted in a scowl. I left the tower because what Elida did wasn't right. They raised you Ammerlin, so I am yours, if you will have me. If you can trust me without the oath rod, you must believe me. And you, Theodrin? Egwene said quickly, schooling her face. Knowing how the sisters felt was bad enough. Hearing it again was painful. I am yours, too, Theodrin sighed, if you'll have me. She spread her hands disparagingly. We are not much, I know, but it looks as though we are all you have. I must admit I was hesitant, Mother. Faerlane is the one who kept insisting we do this. Frankly, she settled her shawl again unnecessarily, and her voice firmed. Frankly, I do not see how you can win out over Romanda and Lelaine. But we are trying to behave as Aes Sedai, even though we aren't really, yet. We will not be that, Mother, whatever you say, until the other sisters see us as Aes Sedai, and that won't happen until we have been tested and have sworn the three oaths. Plucking the folded scrap of parchment out from under the inkwell, Egwene fingered it while she thought. Faerlane was the driving force behind this? That seemed as unlikely as a wolf befriending the shepherd. She suspected dislike was a mild word for what Faerlane felt for her, and the woman must know Egwene hardly saw her as a potential friend. If they had accepted either sitter's arrangement, mentioning the offer might be a good means of disarming her suspicions. Mother, Faerlane said, and stopped, looking surprised at herself. It was the first time she had addressed Egwene so. Drawing a deep breath, she went on. Mother, I know you must have a hard time believing us since we've never held the oath rod, but I wish you would stop bringing that up, Egwene said. It was well to be careful, but she could not afford to refuse every offer of help for fear of plots. Do you think everybody believes Aes Sedai because of the three oaths? People who know Aes Sedai know a sister can stand truth on its head and turn it inside out if she chooses to. Myself, I think the three oaths hurt as much as they help, maybe more. I will believe you until I learn you've lied to me, and I will trust you until you show you don't deserve it, the same way everybody else does with one another. Come to think of it, the oaths did not really change that. You still had to take a sister on trust most of the time. The oaths just made people warier about it, wondering whether and how they were being manipulated. Another thing. You two are Aes Sedai. I don't want to hear any more about having to be tested or hold the oath rod or any of it. Bad enough you have to face that nonsense without parroting it yourselves. Have I made myself clear? The two women standing on the other side of the table murmured hastily that she had, then exchanged long looks. This time it was Faerlane who appeared indecisive. Finally, Theodrin glided around to kneel beside Egwene's chair and kiss her ring. Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, I, Theodrin Dabai, swear fealty to you, Egwene Alvear, to faithfully serve and obey on pain of my life and honor. She looked at Egwene questioningly. It was all Egwene could do to nod. This was no part of Aes Sedai ritual. This was how nobles swore to ruler. Even some rulers did not receive so strong an oath. Yet no sooner had Theodrin risen with a relieved smile than Faerlane took her place. Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, I, Faerlane Orunda. All that she could have wished for and more. From any other sisters, at least, who were not just as likely to be sent to fetch another's dust cloak if the wind rose. When Faolaine finished, she remained kneeling, but stiffly upright. "Mother, there is the matter of my penance. For what I said to you about not liking you, I will set it myself if you wish, but it is your right." Her voice was as rigid as her posture, yet not at all fearful. She looked ready to stare down a lion, eager to, in fact. Biting her lip, Egwene nearly laughed aloud. Keeping her face smooth took effort. Maybe they would take it for a hiccup. However much they claimed they were not really Aes Sedai, Faolaine had just proved how much of one she was. Sometimes sisters set themselves penances in order to maintain the proper balance between pride and humility. That balance was much prized, supposedly, and the only reason given, usually. But certainly none sought to have one imposed. Penance set by another could be quite harsh, and the Ammerlin was supposed to be harder in this than the Ajahs. Either way, though, many sisters made a haughty display of submission to the greater will of the Aes Sedai, an arrogant showing of their lack of arrogance. The pride of humility, Swan called it. She considered telling the woman to eat a handful of soap just to see her expression. Faolaine had a mean tongue. But instead, "I don't hand out penance for telling the truth, daughter, or for not liking me. Dislike to your heart's content, so long as you keep your oath." Not that anyone except a dark friend would break that particular oath. Still, there were ways around almost anything. But weak sticks were better than none when you were fending off a bear. Faolaine's eyes widened, and Egwene sighed as she motioned the woman to rise. Had their positions been reversed, Faolaine would have put her nose firmly in the dust. "I'm setting you two tasks to begin, daughters," she went on. They listened carefully, Faolaine not even blinking, Theodrin with a thoughtful finger to her lips. And this time when she dismissed them, they said, "As you command, mother," in unison as they curtsied. Egwene's good mood was fleeting, though. Mary arrived with her breakfast on a tray as Theodrin and Faolaine departed, and when Egwene thanked her for the rose-petal pomander, she said, "I had a few spare moments, mother." By her expression, that could have been an accusation that Egwene worked her too hard, or that she herself did not work hard enough. Not a pleasant spice for the stewed fruit. For that matter, the woman's face might sour the mint tea and turn the warm, crusty bun hard as a rock. Egwene sent her away before eating. The tea was weak, anyway. Tea was one of the things in short supply. The note that had been under the inkwell proved no better seasoning. "Nothing of interest in the dream," said Swan's fine script. So Swan had been in Telaran Riod last night, too. She did a good deal of spying there. It mattered little whether she had been hunting some sign of Mogedion, though that would have been insanely foolish, or something else. Nothing was nothing. Egwene grimaced, and not just for the nothing. Swan in Telaran Riod last night meant a visit from Lyanna sometime today, complaining. Swan most definitely no longer was allowed any of the dream Terangrial, not since she had tried to teach some of the other sisters about the world of dreams. It was not so much that she knew little more than they, or even that few sisters believed they actually needed a teacher to learn anything, but Swan possessed a tongue like a rasp and no patience. Usually she managed to hold her temper, but two outbursts of shouting and fist-shaking, and she had been fortunate just to find herself denied access to the Terangrial. Lyanna was given one whenever she asked, though, and frequently Swan used it in secret. That was one of the few real bones of contention between them. Both would have been in Telaran Riod every night if they could. With a grimace, Egwene channeled the tiniest spark of fire to set a corner of the parchment alight, and held it until it burned nearly to her fingers. Nothing left to be found by anyone rooting through her belongings and reported where it would rouse suspicions. Breakfast almost done, she was still alone, and that was not usual. Shiriam might well be avoiding her, but Swan should have been there. Popping a last bit of the bun into her mouth and washing it down with a final swallow of tea, she rose to go find her, only to have the object of her intended search stalk into the tent. Had Swan had a tail, she would have been lashing it. "Where have you been?" Egwene demanded, weaving a ward against listeners. "Hail Dean pulled me out of my blankets first thing," Swan growled, dropping onto one of the stools. "She still thinks she'll pump the Ammerlin's eyes and ears out of me. No one gets that. No one." When Swan had first arrived in Salidar, a stilled woman on the run, a deposed Ammerlin the world thought dead, the sisters might well not have let her stay, except that she knew not only the Ammerlin seat's network of agents, but also that of the Blue Aja, which she had run before being raised to the stole. That had given her a certain influence, just as Liana's agents inside Tar Valon had given her some. The arrival of Aeldeen Stonebridge, who had taken her place with the Blue Eyes and Ears, had changed matters for Swan. Aeldeen had been outraged that reports from the handful of Blue agents Swan had managed to reach had been handed to women outside the Aja. That Aeldeen's own position had been revealed. Only two or three sisters were supposed to know, even within the Blue, infuriated her to near apoplexy. She not only snatched back control of the Blue network, not only upbraided Swan in a voice that might have been heard a mile off, she very nearly went for Swan's throat. Aeldeen was from an Andoran mining village in the Mountains of Mist, and it was said her crooked nose came from fighting with her fists when she was a girl. Aeldeen's actions had started others thinking. Egwene returned to her unsteady chair and pushed her breakfast tray aside. "Aeldeen won't take it away from you, Swan, and neither will anyone else." When Aeldeen reclaimed the Blue Eyes and Ears, others had begun thinking that the Blue should not have the Ammerlins as well. No one suggested that it should be in Egwene's control. The Hall was to have it, so Romanda said, and Lelaine. Each intended to be the one in charge, of course, the one those reports came to first, for being first to know had advantages. Aeldeen thought those agents should be added to the Blue network since Swan was Blue. At least Shiriam was content simply to be handed all the reports Swan received, which she usually was. They can't make you give it up. Egwene filled her teacup again, setting it and the blue-glazed honey pot on the corner of the table nearest Swan, but the other woman only stared at them. The anger had gone out of her. She slumped on the stool. "You never really think about strength," she said, half to herself. "You're aware of it, whether you're stronger than somebody else, but you don't think about it. You just know that she defers to you, or you to her. There was no one stronger than me before. No one since." Her eyes dropped to her hands, stirring uneasily on her lap. "Sometimes when Romanda is hammering at me or Lelaine, it suddenly hits me like a gale. They're so far above me now, I should be holding my tongue until they give me permission to speak. Even Aeldeen is, and she's no more than middling." She forced her head upright, mouth tight and voice bitter. "I suppose I'm adjusting to reality. That's ingrained in us too. Driven deep before you ever test for the shawl. But I don't like it. I don't!" Egwene picked up her pen from beside the inkwell and the sand jar, fiddling with it while she chose words. "Swan, you know how I feel about what needs to be changed. There's too much we do because Aes Sedai have always done it that way. But things are changing, no matter who believes it will all go back to how it was. I doubt anyone else was ever raised Ammerlin without being Aes Sedai first. That should have elicited a comment on the White Tower's hidden records. Swan often said there was nothing that had not occurred at least once in the Tower's history, though this did seem to be a first. But Swan sat there disheartened, like a sack. Swan, the Aes Sedai way isn't the only way, and not even always the best. I intend to make sure we follow the best way, and whoever can't learn to change or won't had better learn to live with it." Leaning across the table, she tried to make her expression encouraging. "I never did figure out how wise ones determine precedence, but it isn't strength in the power. There are women who can channel who defer to women who can't. One, Cerulea, would never have made it to accepted, yet even the strongest jump when she says toad." "Wilders," Swan said dismissively, but it lacked force. "Aes Sedai, then. I wasn't raised Ammerlin because I am the strongest. The wisest women are chosen for the hall or to be ambassadors or advisers, the most skillful anyway, not those with the most strength." "Best not to say skillful in what, though Swan certainly possessed those particular skills, too. The hall? The hall might send me for tea. They might have me sweep out when they've finished sitting. Sitting back, Egwene threw down the pen. She wanted to shake the woman. Swan had kept going when she could not channel at all, and now her knees began to fold? Egwene was on the point of telling her about Theodrin and Faelaine. That should get some rise and approval. When she saw an olive-skinned woman ride past the open tent flaps, looking lost in thought beneath the wide gray hat she wore to keep off the sun. "Swan, it's Mirella." Letting the ward go, she rushed outside. "Mirella," she called. Swan needed a victory to wash the taste of being bullied out of her mouth, and this might be just the thing. Mirella was one of Shiriam's lot, and apparently with a secret all her own. Reining in her sorrel gelding, Mirella looked around and gave a start when she saw Egwene. By her expression, the green sister had not realized what part of the camp she was passing through. A thin dust cloak hung down the back of her pale gray riding dress. "Mother," she said hesitantly, "if you will forgive me, I will not forgive you," Egwene cut in, making her flinch. Any doubt vanished that Mirella had heard about last night from Shiriam. "I will talk with you. Now." Swan had come outside, too, but instead of watching the sister climb uneasily from her saddle, she stared down the rows of tents toward a stocky, graying man with a battered breastplate strapped over his buff-colored coat, leading a tall bay in their direction. His presence was a surprise. Lord Bryn usually communicated with the hall by messenger, and his rare visits mostly finished before Egwene learned he had come. Swan assumed such a look of Aes Sedai's serenity, it nearly made you forget her youthful face. Glancing briefly at Swan, Bryn made a leg, handling his sword with a spare grace. A weathered man, he was only moderately tall, but the way he carried himself made him seem taller. There was nothing flashy about him. The sweat on his broad face made him seem to be about a job of work. "Mother, may I speak with you? Alone?" Mirella turned as if to go, and Egwene snapped, "You stay right there, right where you are!" Mirella's mouth dropped open. Her surprise seemed as much for her own obedience as Egwene's decisive tone, and it faded into bitter resignation that she quickly hid behind a cool facade, one belied by the way she twiddled her reins. Bryn did not even blink, though Egwene was sure he at least had an inkling of her situation. She suspected that very little surprised him or unsettled him. Just the sight of him had made Swan ready to fight back, for all it was apparently she who started most of their arguments. Already her fists rested on her hips and her gaze was fixed on him, an auguring stare that should have made anyone uneasy, even had it not come from an Aes Sedai. Mirella offered more than helping Swan, though, perhaps. "I intended to ask you to come this afternoon, Lord Bryn. I ask now." She had questions to put to him. "We can talk then, if you will forgive me." Instead of accepting her dismissal, he said, "Mother, one of my patrols found something just before dawn, something I think you should see for yourself. I can have an escort ready, and no need for that," she broke in quickly. "Mirella, you will come with us. Swan, would you ask someone to bring my horse, please? Without delay." Riding out with Mirella would be better than confronting her here, if Swan's patched-together clues really pointed at anything, and on a ride she could ask Bryn her questions, but neither fueled her haste. She had just spotted Lelaine striding toward her through the tent rows, Takima at her side. With one exception, all the women who had been sitters before Swan was deposed had drifted to either Lelaine or Romanda. Most of the newly chosen sitters went their own way, which was slightly better in Egwene's view. Just slightly. Even at a little distance, the set of Lelaine's shoulders was evident. She looked ready to walk through whatever got in her way. Swan saw her as well and darted off without pausing for so much as a curtsy, yet there was no time to make a clean escape, short of leaping onto Lord Bryn's horse. Lelaine planted herself in front of Egwene, but it was Bryn she fixed with eyes sharp as tacks, considering, calculating what he was doing there. She had larger fish to put on the fire, though. "I must speak with the Ammerlin," she said peremptorily, pointing toward Mirella. "You will wait. I will talk to you after." Bryn bowed, not too deeply, and led his horse where she pointed. Men who had any brains at all soon learned arguments did little good with Aes Sedai, and with sitters the tally was usually none. Before Lelaine could open her mouth, Romanda was suddenly there, radiating command so strongly that at first Egwene did not even notice Varalyn with her, and the slender red-haired sitter for the Grey was inches taller than most men. The only surprise was that Romanda had not appeared sooner. She and Lelaine watched one another like hawks, neither allowing the other near Egwene alone. The glow of Sidar surrounded both women at the same instant, and each wove a ward around the five of them to stop eavesdropping. Their eyes clashed, challenging in faces utterly cool and collected, but neither let her ward drop. Egwene bit her tongue. In a public place it was up to the strongest sister present to decide whether a conversation should be warded, and protocol said the Ammerlin made that decision wherever she was present. She had no desire for the not-quite-apologies mentioning it would bring, though. If she pressed, they would accede, of course, while behaving as though soothing a petulant toddler. She bit her tongue and boiled inside. Where was Swan? That was not fair. Getting horses saddled required more than moments, but she wanted to grip her skirts to keep her hands away from her head. Romanda dropped the staring match first, though not in defeat. She rounded on Egwene so suddenly that Lelaine was left staring past her and looking foolish. "Delana is making trouble again." Her high-pitched voice was almost sweet, but it held a sharpness that emphasized the lack of any title of respect. Romanda's hair was completely grey, gathered in a neat bun on the nape of her neck, but age had certainly not softened her. Takima, with her long black hair and aged ivory complexion, had been almost 9 years a brown sitter, as forceful in the hall as in the classroom, yet she stood a meek pace back, hands folded at her waist. Romanda led her faction as firmly as Cerulea. She was one to whom strength was indeed all important, and in truth Lelaine seemed not far behind. "She plans to lay a proposal before the hall," Lelaine put in sourly, refusing to look at Romanda at all now. Agreeing with the other woman certainly pleased her as little as speaking second. Aware that she had gained an edge, Romanda smiled, a faint curving of her lips. "About what?" Egwene asked, playing for time. She was certain she knew. It was very hard not to sigh. It was very hard not to rub her temples. "Why, the Black Aja, of course, mother," Varalyn replied, lifting her head as if surprised at the question. Well, she might be. Delana was rabid on the subject. "She wants the hall to condemn Elida openly as black." She stopped abruptly when Lelaine raised a hand. Lelaine allowed her followers more leeway than Romanda, or maybe she just did not have as tight a grip. "You must speak with her, mother." Lelaine had a warm smile when she chose to use it. Swan said they had been friends once. Lelaine had accepted her back with some version of welcome, yet Egwene thought that smile a practiced tool. And say what? Her hands ached to soothe her head. These two each made sure the hall passed only what she wanted, certainly little that Egwene suggested, with the result that nothing much at all was passed, and they wanted her to intercede with a sitter. Delana did support her proposals, true, when they suited her. Delana was a weather vane, turning with the last breath of air to pass, and if she turned in Egwene's direction a great deal of late, it did not mean very much. The Black Aja seemed her only fixed point. What was keeping Swan? "Tell her she must stop, mother." Lelaine's smile and tone made her seem to be counseling a daughter. "This foolishness, worse than foolishness, has everyone at dagger's points. Some of the sisters are even beginning to believe, mother. It will not be long before the notion spreads to the servants and the soldiers." The look she directed toward Bryn was full of doubt. Bryn appeared to be attempting to chat with Mirella, who was staring at the warded group and running her reins uneasily through her gloved hands. "Believing what is plain is hardly foolish," Romanda barked. "Mother!" In her mouth, that sounded entirely too much like girl. "The reason Delana must be stopped is she does no good and considerable harm. Perhaps Elida is black, though I have strong doubts, whatever second-hand gossip that trollop Halima brought. Elida is wrong-headed to a fault, but I cannot believe her evil. Yet even if she is, trumpeting it will make outsiders suspicious of every Aes Sedai and drive the black into deeper hiding. There are methods to dig them out, if we don't frighten them into flight. Lelaine's sniff bordered on a snort. Even were this nonsense true, no self-respecting sister would submit to your methods, Romanda. What you've suggested is close to being put to the question. Egwene blinked in confusion. Neither Swan nor Lyanna had brought her a whisper of this. Luckily, the sitters were not paying her enough mind to notice, as usual. Planting her fists on her hips, Romanda squared around on Lelaine. Desperate days demand desperate actions. Some might ask why anyone would put her dignity ahead of exposing the Dark One's servants. That sounds dangerously near an accusation, Lelaine said, eyes narrowing. Romanda was the one smiling now, a cold, flinty smile. I will be the first to submit to my methods, Lelaine, if you are the second. Lelaine actually growled, taking half a step toward the other woman, and Romanda leaned toward her, chin thrust out. They looked ready to begin pulling hair and rolling in the dirt, and Aes Sedai dignity be hanged. Varalyn and Takima glared at one another like two maidservants supporting their mistresses, a long-legged wading bird in a scowling match with a wren. The whole lot of them seemed to have forgotten Egwene entirely. Swan came running up in a broad straw hat, leading a fat dun mare with white-stockinged hind legs, and skidded to a halt when she saw the warded gathering. One of the grooms was with her, a lanky fellow in a long frayed vest and a patched shirt, holding the reins of a tall roan. The wards were invisible to him, but Sidar did not hide the faces. His eyes went very wide, and he began licking his lips. For that matter, passers-by walked wide around the tent and pretended to see nothing. Aes Sedai, warders, and servants alike. Bryn alone frowned and studied them as though wondering what was hidden from his ears. Mirella was retying her saddlebags, plainly on the point of leaving. "When you have decided what I should say," Egwene announced, "then I can decide what to do." They really had forgotten her. All four stared at her in amazement as she walked between Romanda and Lelaine and out through the doubled wards. There was nothing to feel as she brushed by the weave, of course. They had never been made to stop anything as solid as a human body. When she scrambled onto the roan, Mirella drew a deep breath and emulated her in resignation. The wards had vanished, though the glow still enveloped the two sitters, each more the image of frustration than the other as they stood watching. Hurriedly, Egwene donned the thin linen dust cloak that had been draped in front of her gelding saddle and the riding gloves that were tucked into a small pocket in the cloak. A wide-brimmed hat hung from the saddle's high pommel, deep blue to match her dress, with a spray of white plumes pinned slanting across the front that shouted of Chase's hand. Heat she could ignore, but the glare of the sun was another matter. Removing plumes and pin, she tucked them into the saddlebags, put the hat on her head, and tied the ribbons beneath her chin. "Shall we go, mother?" Bryn asked. He was already mounted, the helmet that had been hanging from his saddle now obscuring his face behind steel bars. It looked quite natural on him, as though he had been born for armor. She nodded. There was no attempt to stop them. Lelaine would not stoop to shouting halt in public, of course, but Romanda... Egwene felt a sense of relief as they rode away, yet her head seemed to be splitting. What was she to do about Delanna? What could she do? The main road in this area, a wide stretch of dirt packed so hard nothing could raise dust from it, ran through the army's camp and along the gap between that and the Aes Sedai's. Bryn angled across it, through the rest of the army on the other side. Although the army camp held 30 times or more as many people as the Aes Sedai camp, there seemed to be few more tents than for the sisters and those who served them, all scattered out across the flats and up the hillsides. Most of the soldiers slept in the open, but then it was hard to remember the last time rain had fallen, and there certainly was not a cloud to be seen. Strangely, there were more women than in the sisters' camp, though they seemed fewer at first glance among so many men. Cooks tended kettles, and laundresses attacked great heaps of clothing, while some worked with the horses or wagons. A fair number appeared to be wives. At least they sat about knitting or darning dresses or shirts, or stirring small cook-pots. Armorers had set up almost anywhere she looked, hammers making steel ring on their anvils, and fletchers adding arrows to bundles by their feet, and farriers checking horses. Wagons of every sort and size stood everywhere, hundreds, perhaps thousands. The army seemed to scoop up every one it found along its path. Most of the foragers were already out, but a few high-wheeled carts and lumbering wagons still trundled away in search of farms and villages. Here and there soldiers raised a cheer as they rode by. "Lord Bryn!" and "The Bull! The Bull!" That was his sigil. Nothing about Aes Sedai or the Ammerlin seat. Egwene twisted around in her saddle to make sure Mirella was still close behind. She was, letting her horse follow on its own, a far-off, slightly sickly expression on her face. Swan had taken a position at the rear, shepherd to their lone sheep. Then again she might just have been afraid to urge her mount ahead. The dun was positively a butterball, but Swan would probably treat a pony like a warhorse. Egwene felt a stab of irritation at her own animal. His name was Daishar, glory in the old tongue. She would much rather be riding Bella, a shaggy little mare not much slimmer than Swan's dun that she had ridden out of the Two Rivers. Sometimes she thought she must look a doll, perched atop a gelding that could be taken for a warhorse, but the Ammerlin had to have a proper mount, no shaggy cart-horses. Even if this rule was of her own making, she felt as confined as a novice. Turning in the saddle, she said, "Do you expect any opposition ahead, Lord Bryn?" He glanced at her sideways. She had asked the same once before, leaving Salidar, and twice while crossing Altara. Not enough to rouse suspicions, she thought. "Murundi is like Altara, mother. Neighbor too busy scheming against neighbor or outright fighting him, to band together for anything short of a war, and not to any great degree then." His tone was very dry. He had been captain general of the Queen's Guards in Andor, with years of border skirmishes against the Murandians behind him. "Andor will be another matter, I fear. I'm not looking forward to that." He turned another way, climbing a gentle slope to avoid three wagons rumbling over rocks in the same direction. Egwene tried not to grimace. Andor. Before, he had just said no. These were the tail end of the Cumbar Hills, somewhat south of Lugard, the capital of Murundi. Even if they were lucky, the border of Andor lay at least 10 days ahead. "And when we reach Tarvalen, Lord Bryn, how do you plan to take the city?"
"No one has asked me that yet, mother."
She had only thought his voice was dry before. Now it was dry.
"By the time we reach Tarvalen, the Light Willing, I'll have 2 or 3 times as many men as I do now."
Egwene winced at the idea of paying so many soldiers. He did not seem to notice.
"With that I will lay siege. The hardest part will be finding ships, and sinking them to block North Harbor and South Harbor. The harbors are as much the key as holding the bridge towns, mother. Tarvalen is larger than Kyrian and Camelon together. Once food stops going in..." He shrugged. "Most of soldiering is waiting, when it isn't marching."
"And if you don't have that many soldiers?" She had never thought of all those people going hungry, women and children. She had never really thought of anyone being involved except the Aes Sedai and the soldiers. How could she have been so foolish? She had seen the results of war in Kyrian. Bryn seemed to take it so lightly. But then he was a soldier. Privation and death must be every day to soldiers.
"What if you only have, say, what you do now?" "Siege?"
Apparently some of what they had been saying had finally broken into whatever Mirella was thinking. She booted the sorrel forward, making a number of men jump aside, some falling on their faces. A few opened their mouths angrily, then saw her ageless features and shut their jaws again, glowering. They might as well not have existed for all of her.
"Arthur Hawkwing besieged Tarvalen for 20 years and failed."
Abruptly she realized ears were about and lowered her voice, but it was still acid.
Do you expect us to wait 20 years?
That acid washed over Gareth Bryn without leaving a stain.
Would you prefer a direct assault right off, Mirella Sedai?
He could have been asking whether she wanted her tea sweet or bitter.
Several of Hawkwing's generals tried, and their men were slaughtered. No army has ever managed to breach Tarvalen's walls.
That was not strictly true, Egwene knew.
In the Trolloc Wars, an army of Dreadlord-led Trollocs had actually plundered and burned a part of the White Tower itself. At the end of the War of the Second Dragon, an army trying to rescue Gwer Amalasan before he was gentled had reached the tower, too. Mirella could not know, though, much less Bryn. Access to those secret histories hidden deep in the tower library was set out in a law that was itself secret, and revealing the existence of either records or law was treason. Swan said if you read between the lines, you found hints of things that had not been recorded even there. Aes Sedai were very good at hiding truth when they thought it necessary, even from themselves.
With 100,000, or what I have now, Bryn continued, I will be the first, if I can block the harbors. Hawkwing's generals never managed that. The Aes Sedai always raised those iron chains in time to stop the ships getting into the harbor mouth, and sank them before they could be placed to hinder trade. Food and supplies got in. It will come to your assault eventually, but not until the city's weakened, if I have my way.
His voice was still ordinary, a man discussing an outing. His head turned toward Mirella, and though his tone did not change, the intensity in his eyes was evident even behind his face guard.
And you all agreed I would when it came to the army. I won't throw men away.
Mirella opened her mouth, then closed it slowly. Plainly she wanted to say something, but did not know what. They had given their word, she and Shiriam and those who had been running things when he appeared in Salidar, however much giving it galled. However much the sitters tried to get round it, they had given no word. Bryn acted as though they had, though, and so far he had managed to get away with it. So far.
Egwene felt ill. She had seen war. Images flashed in her head, men fighting, killing their way through the streets of Tarvalen, dying. Her eyes fell on a square-jawed fellow chewing his tongue while he sharpened a pike-head. Would he die in those streets? The grizzled, balding man running his fingers so carefully down each arrow before sliding the shaft into his quiver. And there, that lad swaggering in his high riding boots. He looked too young to shave. Light. So many were boys. How many would die? For her. For justice. For the right. For the world. But at the heart, for her.
Swan raised her hand, but did not complete the gesture. Had she been close enough, she could not pat the Ammerlin seat on the shoulder where everyone could see.
Egwene straightened her back.
"Lord Bryn," she said in a tight voice, "what is it you want me to see?"
She thought he half-glanced at Mirella before answering.
"Better you see it for yourself, mother."
Egwene thought her head might break open. If Swan's clues led to anything at all, she might just skin Mirella. If they did not, she might skin Swan, and she might throw Gareth Bryn in for good measure.